This is why we love racing in all its forms.
And it's Lochinvar Arts, Pride's Easy Feed Victoria Cup.
The rail now for Zipping Rambo goes through in the Sandown Cup.
Twilight Payment, what a ride, what a win in a cup we'll never forget.
For the next hour, RSN is cracking the codes.
Looking forward to cracking the codes this morning because I'm looking forward to the company of Dan and Simone, and then I'm looking forward to a bit more of Dan later on with Felgate, and then I'm looking forward to watching Group 1 action from Sandown, which is a rare thing these days for the Underwood Stakes and Zaki. G'day, Dan. G'day, Simone.
It certainly is. Good morning,
G'day,
Matthew.
Dan.
How's your week been?
And there's
been
a footy game later too.
Yeah.
Is there?
I would normally be into it because it's Melbourne and Footscray in the old, and they're, you know, two Ripper Victorians. Bit out of sight, out of mind for me. I'll watch it, but I'll watch it. I've talked myself around.
I've got zero interest, so I'm being very honest, brutally honest.
I'm glad I brought that up then, guys.
Yeah. I eventually came around and Simone just kicked it. What are you going to be doing? Yeah. What are you going to be doing when that's on, Simone?
I'm actually working at the Saddlery Saturday, or today. Saturday, yes. So I will probably enjoy talking horses to people more than watching football, put it that way. If it was the Melbourne Cup, you know, we do take a bit of time. And when the Olympics were on, we were actually crowded with customers around the computer screens watching the Australians do their cross-country or their show jumping, whatever it was at the time. And so really embraced it. But I cannot say I have anywhere near the same passion for football. So
dear.
We'll just, Dan, just tell me the result at the end of
the
day.
All right, I'll text you the result. Dan, do you have a passion for Sandown, Dan?
You know what I do, Matt? You know, and, you know, we mentioned that word romance, but I feel there is Sandown. You know, growing up when I was a kid at that impressionable age, I'd go there and practice. I'd practice my race calling in about the 300 in where the car racing pits were. And you needed that little bit of a break from the wind. And look, it's a wonderful racetrack. It always has been. And it gets the spotlight on it today with a Group 1 race, and perhaps the best horse in Australasia is there, and it's a very good race program.
It is. Did I ever tell you about the time I did four fast laps with Marcus Ambrose, the V8 driver? So I went out there to do a story on what it was like to do a fast lap with a lunatic like Marcus Ambrose, who then went to drive NASCARs in America.
Yep.
And I'm in the sheds for the whole day before it, and it was a really hot day, and I was in this spacesuit thing. They eventually had to shove me through the window because the door didn't open to this car.
Yeah, and one of
One of the blokes said in the shed said, "With Marcus, there's no foreplay." He said this is not going to be a fun experience for you. So, what he meant was Marcus doesn't treat amateurs like me kindly. So we got in the car, and he deliberately conked it out about four times. And he said, oh, look, if you start to panic, you can do what my grandmother did and tap me on the knee, and that tells me to slow down. I thought, oh, you mongrel, you're going to make me do what your grandma did. So anyway, he absolutely terrorised me for three laps, and then the last lap I kind of got the hang of it, but I was just in a muck lather, and it was like heading towards the edge of a cliff when you're heading to a turn, and then off you went. And in the end, it was an okay experience, and I really fanged my own car on the way home.
You're going slower than what you are. But I went in with John Bauer once, similar to what you did. It's pretty uncomfortable where you have to sit. I tell you one thing, first hand, when you're that close, is the noise of those V8s at the time. You couldn't hear yourself think they were that loud.
No, exactly. So it's on the inside of the track, the racetrack, Hillside and Lakeside, the outside, and there's always this threat to Sandown that it's not going to be around forever, that they're going to sell it off to pay for Caulfield and it'll become a housing estate, and who knows what's really going to happen. But as you say, Dan, there's a sense of nostalgia about Sandown, and Simone, there was for Olympic Park and there was for Melton as well, Dan, back in the day. I'm not saying Sandown's going to go tomorrow, but once they're gone forever, aren't they?
That's it. There's no coming back. And we know a few changes in the metropolitan area in each of the codes over the last, you know, 20 or 30 years. But still, it's hard to embrace. And I think participants, punters as well, they don't easily, they don't resist as easily as perhaps the authorities would like them to. I mean, I still occasionally can make a faux pas and talk about the Melton meeting and mention Moonee Valley, you know, subliminally almost. And it's not that much different when you mention the Meadows, sometimes also Olympic Park, and it'll be difficult with Sandown as well, I think. But I think it's also great that they got such a good program on today. Simone, do you find yourself, you know, thinking of sometimes what is referred to as the Halcyon days?
I do. It makes me feel very old too. But Olympic Park for sure, and the bar downstairs, and when, you know, I was there when there were changes with the bookmakers, how they got a little bit smaller and some renovations and all that. So I do have very fond memories of Olympic Park, and also the runners, the athletics were on, yeah, on a Monday night in between the dog races. So they'd have sprinters.
Yeah, with the bookies betting on them, they were great. Yeah,
and you used to walk the dogs in the adjacent oval, which is where I think Richmond were training at the time. So it brings back those memories, and when I talk about it, it doesn't seem really that long ago that I was doing that, but I know that it was. And also Moonee Valley on a Saturday night.
When did it close?
I called the last race.
Early 90s? Maybe.
Yeah, 1999 was the year that the Meadows opened. Late 1999.
Remember Congressman was the greyhound that won the last race. I called it for Sky Channel, but I can't remember. Is it about 95, ring a bell?
I remember going across from work, and we'd sit in that towering grandstand, which was sort of way too big for how high you were looking at the greyhounds. Hey, let's, Dan, to set the scene for Sandown today, you've got three possibles for a replay of an Underwood. Which one are we going to go with?
Eeny, meeny, miny, mate. Well, I tell you what, we've mentioned this particular race a few times in the last couple of weeks because we were both young, and I went there practicing calling. Then I went to watch Hawthorne training before the grand final, because it used to be a public holiday Thursday. It was show day, and there were two Group 1 races, and the Underwood we run on that program. And this particular day, which you had a good story about, I think you wagged school with Adam Hamilton, didn't you, and went to Caulfield. Correct. And this is what we saw when we were just teenagers.
Bone Crusher drew level and hit the front from Glenn Morris and Feeder Away. The other New Zealander, the Filbert, is running on from Allward, Summer, Samara, Tristark, and then Black Knight to the outside, out Talak, badly blocked for room. Bone Crusher's dashed away, three in front into the straight. The Filbert second from At Talak, running on Always Summer. Further back, Tristark struggling with Our Sophia. At the 200, At Talak out after Bone Crusher's pegging it back at every stride. Bone Crusher the leader. At Talak challenging the inside, but Bone Crusher will win. He's hanging on, and he comes away again to win a length to At Talak. Five lengths away, third, Black Knight from the Filbert.
What about the crowd, guys?
It sounded just a small, intimate gathering, didn't it, Dan?
You know, but when Bill said, and Bone Crusher kicks away by three, wow, you know, the crowd just got involved. They were so reactive to what Bill was saying. He was on the PA as well as on the radio, but it still puts, you know, the hairs, what's left on my head and the back of my neck.
There's plenty on the back of your neck, not many on your head.
That's true.
Yes. I listened to, I watched that race and, or that replay, and listened to it, and Bone Crusher was probably, I don't want to say he ignited my love of horse racing or anything, but he's probably the horse past Farlap that I've loved and remembered because he's so big. I love the name Bone Crusher. I thought it was something a little bit more macabre as someone who was perhaps interested in taxidermy, but I have since found out that it was it was to do with him having a bone injury, and they called him Bone Crusher, and I just really loved the horse. So it's sort of, and listening to that, and Black Knight, did he win the 1982 Melbourne Cup?
84, I think you'll find.
Yeah, yes. There you go.
Well, there you go. So, lots of memories there. Yeah. Hey, guys, we've got a chock-full show this morning, and we do have two terrific guests, and we'll let them explain their stories. I won't set the scene for all three, actually, two in one, for these guests. So we're going to take a break on Cracking the Codes and come back with our first guest.
Loving their racing, pacing and chasing. Matt Stewart, Dan Malicki and Simone Fisher. Cracking the Codes.
I have taken the liberty of crossing the codes this morning and jumping from greyhounds to both standard breeds or harness racing and thoroughbred racing. And we've got two very special guests on the show this morning, husband and wife team Bronwyn Dobay and Warren Cochran. And they run Cobay Lodge, which is in Barringup, out near Malden. And their story is very, very interesting. So I'll let them tell us that. So good morning, Warren and Bronwyn.
Good morning. How are you going?
Yeah, we're great. Now, I know you're probably both itching to give your life story or how this all evolved, but I'll let you two decide who can just take us down memory lane a little bit and tell us how you've ended up where you are.
Sure. I'll let Bronwyn go. She probably can explain a better than I can.
Oh, well, it's probably... We've got our own stories. So my background is really in show jumping and pony club and eventing and what have you, and always had a love of horses and dabbled a little bit with friends in the thoroughbred industry early on in my teens. But... Warren and I have built a equine education business together, initially in New Zealand. We've been in Australia 9.5 years. We sort of love all things horses, and we've got quite a varied background. I guess my background was in the sport industry, but Warren, you might like to sort of chip in here because you've got the harness background with your family and being a farrier and who the guys that you were working for many years. So that would be quite interesting, I think, for you guys to hear about.
Yeah, well, I sort of started off as a high country muster and stuff in New Zealand, and then started working in trotting stables. Started working for a fellow, Steve Little. He had a really good trotter called Troppo. He raced in the Inter Dominions and so on. And then I went from there, worked for Robert Dunn. And Robert, that was about the time he had Master Musician. He was only just an early two-year-old when I started working for Robert. And I was actually, I was allowed to drive him and work until then they discovered how good he was, and I soon got the drag there. I'd done a lot of driving and so on in New Zealand, and sort of become a farrier and spent 20 odd years in New Zealand, mainly showing standard breeds for some of Canterbury's biggest stables, like the Robert and Jeff Dunn, Cran Dalgetty, Nigel McGrath, Robbie Holmes, and guys like that. So, yeah. And then and I've also held a trainer's licence and trained some horses myself. And yeah.
God, you make my life look pathetic. You've done so much. There's something that you said early on, because I've got a kid who's a bit of a high mountain musterer who hangs around Mansfield area, and I've never thought about the high cattle mustering of New Zealand. I'm assuming cattle. Where are the highlands of New Zealand that you were mustering, and what were you mustering?
I started off sort of down the middle of the South Island. Sort of, it was mostly merino sheep. And sort of a few cattle. One station I worked on was Adam Carter Station. That was 130,000 acres, high country stuff. And some of it was pretty rugged country. Then I went to Molesworth Station, which is the biggest station in New Zealand, and it's just all cattle. So it's 500,000 acres.
Is one of those the one where they film Lord of the Rings?
No, I don't think so. I think they done that sort of stuff down around Queenstown.
Right, okay.
Yeah. But, so I was, and then I spent a bit of time, because a lot of the stations is just sort of seasonal work, so you might spend 8-9 months at one station, and then you sort of look for winter work, like fencing and stuff like that. But then I came over to Australia one winter rodeoing, and because I used to do a bit of that as well. And when I went back to New Zealand, I started working in the trotting stables, because I initially wanted to be a jockey, but when I was a kid, left school to be a jockey, but I got too big for that, so I went down the trotting way.
Warren, when you mention rodeo, bucking broncs and the like, ears prick up and you think, wow, that'd be interesting. Tell us about that, because
I can see what Bronwyn found in him. High cattle, mustering, you know, rodeo, strutting around in the bloody, yeah.
Yeah,
was is he was a farrier, and he promised me that I would never, ever wait for the farrier to shoe my own horse.
Oh, that's what got him over the line, was it?
Yeah.
I can relate to that. I can relate to that, Bronwyn. It's so hard getting a farrier, or a farrier, and when you've got a good one, you've got to stick to the diet.
I still have problems. After the honeymoon phase, I was still having the same issues as everybody else.
Tell him to lift his game.
Well, that's a good little secret for budding, singles out there. If they want to partner up, just do a farrier course, and everything happens for you.
Yeah, no, Bron said, once the honeymoon period's over, you sort of, the last thing you want to do when you come home at night is do more trimming or shoeing. So, so you've got to get your arm twisted a bit sometimes.
Now, guys, you're in Barring Up. You run Kobe Lodge and you are equine educators. Sometimes you need to educate people too, I'm sure. But can you tell us about the operation now? Because as a holistic approach to racing, it has changed. We think about the whole life cycle of the greyhounds or the horses these days, and often, or now, we see a lot more work is put into the preparation of yearlings and foals in handling, and even with the greyhounds with pups, to ensure that when they transition to that afterlife of racing, that they are well-grounded and they have good confidence to, you know, head into the new world. So can you tell us about now you've got a terrific horse called Suave Stewie Lombo, who you are using as an educator with the yearlings?
Yes, so I guess our philosophy is one of, we've spent a lot of years training with a very good New Zealand horseman called Tokari Tafata. And he's taught us an awful lot. We have a huge amount of respect for him, and we still call on him every now and then when we get a bit stuck or think that we need another method or to help a horse. But essentially, we sort of feel that the beginning of it all is the most important foundation for the horse to be a successful racehorse, and then that flows into life after racing. So the more confidence we can give them and what they're being expected to do, the more likely they are to be successful or to be able to perform to their best ability anyway. So, and part of our process is we use Stewie on the yearlings and older horses, some of the problem horses. He can initially be a bit unsure about it. Like, he's not the bravest horse around, actually, but he has a great relationship with Warren. So I'll let Warren tell you a bit about how they actually worked through it and how he was as a when we were trying to get him under saddle, because he wasn't easy. He was a bit quirky himself. So that's probably best for Warren to tell you about.
Yeah, well, when we first got Stu, he's, like Bronwyn said, he was a bit quirky, and Lauren Tritton that trained him, and Lauren Shane, they said, I think Lauren tried to ride him one time, and she said her life flashed between her eyes, sort of thing. She thought she was going to die. So, and he is a nervy type of horse. Like, when you're riding him, he thinks everything's got a boogie monster behind a tree or anything like that. But I just started working on him and riding him, and he really came good, and we sort of got a good connection. And because of his sensitivity, he was actually quite easy to train to move off my leg, and he was quite keen to learn, but you just had to give him time to think about it. And then one day I said to Brom, I said, I reckon Stewie might make not a bad boss horse. And to tell the truth, he was actually in the paddock, he was a bit of a loner, and we thought, the boss in the paddock, and nobody wants to sort of be with him. But it was actually more the fact that he was a bit of a loner and he didn't really have the confidence. But once I started using him as a boss horse and pushing young horses around and stuff, he gained in confidence, and then all of a sudden he became the boss of the paddock too, which was quite funny to see that go on.
Mick Kent's got an old standard bred that they use as a stable pony and they ride it. Dan, you might have a take on this as well. How many, are there many standard breds that actually get ridden during their life?
Well, Village Kid, Warren, you might remember Village Kid. He was New Zealand bred, one of the champions of Australasian harness racing. Yep. When he went to Bill Horn and spent his time over there, most of the time he rode him on the beats with the thoroughbreds. So I know it's not, well, it's still a little unusual, but it can happen maybe depending on, you know, where horses are trained and the like. But have you heard of that often?
Yeah, like I think it's probably not done quite so much now as what it may have been in the older days. So one trainer I worked for, everything we broke in was ridden, just as part of their education. But I think it's few and far between now. And some I think. It can help a lot of straight-out trotters that have been ridden to help them, especially if they're a little bit unruly.
I was going to ask you about that, because it's about the relationship between the rider or the driver eventually and the horse, and there's a lot of intimacy when you, and as Simone would know, when you're riding a horse. Do you think, Warren, that should be a tool as the education of a standard bred in order to have a better relationship with the driver eventually, but the person who is handling it most, that they do have that sort of relationship?
Well, I think, if it's a driver that's going to be driving the horse all the time, a bit of ridden work with that driver wouldn't be too bad at all. I guess, nowadays, especially with all the freelance drivers and so on, it's a bit hard to get that relationship going, sort of, you know.
We did find when we educate our horses that we ride all of them, and we had a nice, he wasn't a great horse. He got a couple of wins for us, but he was no superstar. But because he'd had such a riding education and we'd balanced him so well, he was amazing in the mouth. And I know that when Warren drove him, he could drive him on his little finger.
I guess that's sort of the sort of thing I'm talking about, those little one percenters that you can gain from having that previous relationship. Yeah,
definitely. And so because he was so well balanced, you could make very small adjustments in a race with him not having a major reaction. So you know, I think the better educated they are, the more malleable they are. And, you can keep them balanced and less risk of breaking or getting into trouble, things like that. So definitely an advantage, I think.
Well, the Stewie that we've been talking about is Suave Stewie Lombo, which is such a very important part of your setup now. He's obviously retired from racing, but two-time Group 1 winner, 33 wins he had, almost $600,000 in prize money. And a lot of our listeners, the harness enthusiasts, will remember Suave Stewie Lombo. He won an APG as a two-year-old. Here is one of his best wins.
But the leader, Mac Beauty, Pinella goes for home, coming out at a Suave Stewie Lombo. They come away from Freiburg. It's Mac Beauty, Suave Stewie Lombo, inch by inch, is wearing down the stable, mate. Stewie's put the head in front. Suave Stewie Lombo's coming away the last little bit, and Suave Stewie Lombo goes home to score. Second home, Mac Beauty. Third home is Freiburg, followed then by Gaius Caesar.
And he's got a 149.6 next to his name, which is quite extraordinary time.
When you have a racehorse that's been so good, like Suave Stewie Lombo, and we see it in the thoroughbreds, and one that really jumps out to me is a friend of mine, Fiona McIntyre, who has 4-time Melbourne Cup runner precedence out on the show circuit. He's about 17 or 18 years old now, and she's told me stories of how he had like very severe bits when he was racing, and he was not the easiest, but now he's out there kicking goals, or he has been for many, many years. And does it fascinate you as well when you get a horse like Suave Stewie Lombo that's obviously quirky and sensitive, was so good on the racetrack and has transitioned so well into his new life?
We actually talk about that quite a bit with him because we're very fond of the old fella. He's quirky, and he doesn't like to be caught every day. You've got to be a bit sneaky. He doesn't like change, but we love every part of him. And once he's in and doing his job, he's amazing to watch work now because he understands what his job is, and he that really backs Warren with these young horses, because they can be a bit bulky and think they can come in and be in charge. And Warren can shift these horses around without manhandling the baby. So, but he's just, there's something very special about him, and you can just, looking at him and the way he carries himself in the paddock, that he has that natural cadence and natural way of going, that he knows how to use his body, and he just, he's uphill and quite unusual, really, for a standard bred, the way he sort of moves. And we just said the other day, look, he just looks, that's why he's a good horse. That's why he was special. He's got it all there, and it's all put together in the right place.
Warren, is a standard, we had an issue that emerged a few weeks ago of the difficulty that was exposed in rehoming thoroughbreds, that there just aren't enough happy paddocks, and some of them don't transition. They're not ideal for equestrian compared to warm bloods and all that sort of stuff. What's the market like? How easy is it to transition a standard bred into afterlife as a riding hack or something like that? And is there a healthy market for it?
Yeah, it is. Prior to sort of getting back into educating and retraining the thoroughbreds and just all types of horses, we spent 5 years with the Hero program. So we got a really good market with the retired standard breeds, and they actually transitioned really well to ridden horses. Some took a little bit longer, but as a rule, they transitioned to some horses. Like I could, when I got them, I could ride the first day when they came to us, and they were like a duck to water. They just loved it. And then some other horses, they just tend to take a little bit longer to gain the confidence and what, because the biggest issue was them getting used to you being above them.
Warren, I'm a thoroughbred girl, but I totally respect the standard breeds, and I see the need for them. I see them transitioning into many, many homes in the equestrian world these days. But I love the thoroughbreds. How can you convince me, or what can you tell us the differences, I suppose, in the standard bred versus thoroughbred in trainability? What's easier to work with? We know standies are usually very level-headed. Thoroughbreds can be a bit hot, but that can be a bit of a myth in some cases. So what can you tell us about both breeds or differences?
Well, yeah, like you say, it's really the standard breed do tend to be a bit more level-headed, but I think nowadays some of the standard breeds, they're sort of almost thoroughbred-y even in their look. So some of the blood coming out of America, sort of, yeah, some of the horses are a little bit hotter than they have been in the past. But generally, the standard breed are a bit more level-headed. But I guess it all really comes down to that early education and what you do with them and building their confidence. And it doesn't matter what breed of horse they are. It's that early education you do with them and just having them comfortable with what you're asking and not sort of going through to the next stage until they're actually comfortable to do it. So it's about that early education, I think.
And Warren, with your intuitive nature with both the breeds, certainly that would certainly have helped you. You've almost completed your Cert 4 in racing. So looking to have your trainer's license and get out on the thoroughbred circuit now.
Yes, yes. So that's another chapter. I've always had an inkling to do the thoroughbred things. Like I said, I wanted to be a jockey when I was a kid. So it was actually quite funny. I think it was Melbourne Cup time a day last year, and I said to Brom, I says, we're watching the Melbourne Cup, and I says, I just have a feeling I really need to train thoroughbreds, and I sort of love to do it. And she says, no, you've got enough to do. And but then we sort of talked about it and decided to go for it. And I'll probably be a dual license holder, because we've bred a Franca Nelson. She's a weanling now, out of a 152 Max 3 mare. So, I'll have both going around.
Warren, I think you're misreading the play here. Bronwyn fell in love with you because of your farriering. She didn't fall in love with you because of your rodeoing or your high plainsing or your training or anything like that. It's because of your shoeing of horses. And now you're doing one more thing to get away from that. So I hope you realise where this is heading.
Oh, I think she's quite happy to go along with it. She knows how, after 30-odd years of being a farrier, how broken I am. So I think she's quite happy for me to just play around and do something we enjoy now.
Oh, look, it's been wonderful having you on Cracking the Codes this morning, Bronwyn and Warren, and loved your stories. And for anyone that's interested in more of your life story and what you do, there's plenty of information on the internet under Kobe Lodge and on Twitter and the like. Tanya McDermott's penned some beautiful stories about your operation, so you can certainly have a look further if people are interested and find out more. But it's been wonderful having you on Cracking the Codes this morning, and we'll be looking out for you when you're on the thoroughbred circuit, Warren, and good luck with all the training.
Thank you very much, and hopefully we can train a group one out of one day.
And we'll get you back on Cracking the Codes.
Good on you, Bronwyn, and good on you, Warren. And Warren, we've given you a little tip. Just do the shoeing on the weekends. Just keep your head in the ring. Good on you, guys.
Yes, I appreciate it.
Good on you, guys. Thanks for that. Dan, do you and Simone, do you ever feel... I felt pathetic when he was telling me, Warren, and I'm sure Bronwyn has had, obviously with her equestrian as well, has had an amazing life. I started thinking of the outlaw Josie Wales and the High Plains Drifter and sort of
that's
Roman.
My favourite Western Clint.
I love the outlaw Josie Wales too. I do love that movie. Haven't watched it for a while. Maybe that's what I've got to do tonight, Saturday night. Flick between the dogs and a Western.
I reckon that was the one with the famous line when he had the bloke with the barge across the river and... He said something like, "Are you going to let me go across the river or are you going to whistle Dixie?" And the bloke started whistling Dixie. But I think Warren's like that.
I think there's another line in that movie. I'm sure it's that one. Don't pee down my back and tell me it's raining. I think that was from the Outlaw Josie Wales as well.
Can you? Dan and I are only going to accept it if you do it in a Clint Eastwood voice, Simone.
No, I'm not even going
yours
to.
Yours was pretty
that.
Good, Matt.
No,
yours
I'm very good, Matt. I'm very good at that sort of stuff. Very good.
Yes, yeah, we can tell.
Hey, can I just, guys, before we move on, where were you when the earthquake struck?
Well, we weren't sitting at RSN absolutely. You know,
being courageous like I was. Yes. All right, I'll let you go.
It was quite.
The interview was over anyway. I was trying to wind him up anyway. Like I certainly wouldn't have abandoned him and fled down the lift had it been the start of the cross. So
well, I actually missed out on the whole thing. Darren had arrived home from trials. I went over to the kennel to help him put the dogs away, and heard on the radio in the background, but wasn't really listening, but heard someone say something about an earthquake. And I thought, oh, there must have been a tremor in Melbourne. And I came inside and Darcy's going, Mum, did you hear the earthquake? Did you feel it? I fell off the bed and the windows were rattling. And I thought, oh, sure.
How oblivious are you to what's around you? How did you not notice the earthquake?
We didn't feel it at all.
Were you and Darren having an argument and you were distracted?
Probably yelling at some dogs to stop barking or something like that. But I honestly did not feel a thing. I was oblivious to it all.
What were you doing at 9:16 a.m. on earthquake day, Dan?
No, actually, I was in bed, but I was awake, but my eyes still hadn't caught up with the rest of my body yet, so they were still closed. And I had the two dogs next to me. And I'd heard the rumbling coming through, so I felt like I knew what it was, because we had one about, 10-odd years ago, and one thing about the tremor then was that it seemed to come through the roof. It was like this really heavy gust of wind that come through, so I'd heard it before and thought that I knew what it was, but the two dogs next to me, they did not flinch. They did not move a muscle. Because usually animals, they get a bit of a sense of what's going to happen before it actually happens. They didn't move, and I thought, if they're not going to panic, neither am I.
Well, your dogs just aren't intuitive, because Wine Shop Dave, the first person I thought of was the bloke who had 4,000 wine bottles piled on top of each other in a wine shop. So I rang him up and I said, did you A, where were you? And I said, B, how much damage down at the shop? Because I imagined a sea of Shiraz washing down Bay Road, Sandringham. He said, I was in bed, and he said, the two dogs, he said, 5 seconds before it happened, their two dogs came bolting in and scrambled under the bed.
Yeah.
And I said, what happened at the shop? He said, you wouldn't believe it. He said, one bottle fell from the very top of the pile, basically the racks, and didn't
you
smash.
That's why you don't put Grange up at the top.
And didn't smash.
Really?
Right. I spoke to Gerald Egan at the Epicenter at Mansfield. He said he had a cup of tea that nearly hopped off the kitchen table. So,
well, Matt, you've got a chance to redeem yourself. I think you need to tell us. All we heard was that snippet of radio where you abandoned ship, and I thought, well, if ever I'm in dire straits, I don't really think I want to be there with you because you'll leave me stranded. But did you head when you said to I'll let you go? What happened?
I casually walked around the office on the eighth floor to make sure everyone was okay, comforted the weeping. Made everyone a hot
casually,
cup of hot
quickly.
Cocoa, padded the walls in case there was a fall down. I set up some pillars with some balsa wood just to reinforce the building. No, I actually went straight to the lift and went outside. But everyone
that
else did as well.
That would have been more scary, going down a lift.
No, I think getting out of the building was my priority.
Oh. Did you know what it was right at that moment?
For the first 5 seconds, Mikey Velasaris, you know what I thought it was? You know how you have weird thoughts?
Yeah.
I thought the striking mob of anti-vaxxers and whoever else was in their ridiculous group, I thought they were physically shaking the building because they're not far from here. I thought,
probably a block away.
I thought, why are they targeting our humble radio station with their violence? What have we done to upset the CFMEU outcasts? So anyway, I went outside, Simone, and it was quite, you know, everyone else from the other buildings had as well, and then once it was safe to come back, you know, return. But I was really tingly. And I said to the kids, I said, this is your Elvis moment. This is where were you? You know, so.
Well, I've had experience in that area, guys. I was in Christchurch. They had a number of earthquakes, but it was the second big one. But it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. So as a bit different to 9 a.m. where you can run out onto the street at 2 a.m., obviously, you know, not saying you can't, but it's quite different. I was on the eighth floor and I felt like I knew what it was. It was about the same, about a 6 on the Richter scale, but the next big one was when everything just came down. You know, we were in November. Mm. The big one was in early February. But when it happened, I knew what it was, but it wasn't the way I thought it was going to be. I think of an earthquake and everything just, you know, shaking. Mm. But it wasn't. It was like this, like I was on the biggest swell of an ocean.
It's
and
bigger
it was
than just a shake,
from
isn't
wide
it?
To wide. Yeah, but I was on the eighth floor, you know?
Yeah. No,
there was
it's
one,
weird.
Oh, sorry. One other quick little story with earthquakes, and I'd forgotten about it until Mum said to me yesterday. She said they were in Nepal. If you can remember at Kathmandu, they had an earthquake in Nepal about 5 or 6 years ago. And I was in London and waiting to, you know, filling in time to catch my flight home. And Mum and Dad were in Nepal at the same time. And my brother texted me something about an earthquake in Nepal, and I thought, oh, I hope Mum and Dad are okay. I've got no way of contacting them. Anyway, I'm sitting on the plane eventually, and I see all the news on the TV on the plane about this earthquake in Nepal. And thankfully, Mum and Dad were okay, but they were walking around Kathmandu, filling in the last hour of the day before they were getting to the airport as well. And they were with their porter, who had gone up Everest to base camp with them, and there's a monument in the middle of the town square, and it's you climb up steps to get up to the top. And Mum said, oh, do you want to go up there? And the porter said, I'm scared of heights. No. And which seems funny when he's climbing up mountains that are however many feet tall, but he's scared of heights going up in a confined space. So they didn't. And it was only maybe 20 minutes later that monument came down. Wow. So that was it was one of those moments.
Sliding
that Dad
doors.
Was, yeah, Dad was very, Mum said he was very shaken up yesterday. It brought back all those memories. But they were all okay. But, I've sort of forgotten about that. So I was oblivious to everything that happened on Wednesday.
You're listening to Cracking the Codes. Now, every now and then, we don't mind throwing in a song or two. And for this morning, with good reason, guys, we've had David Murphy on before. He is the co-lead singer of the band, mainly made up of family, of Old Melbourne Road. Now, they've got a new album out, and one of the songs has been co-written by another trainer driver in Glen Conroy, from the famous Conroy clan, and David, and they've put it into song, and this is it. It's called Quick and Clean off their album Proper.
Set it free.
Now, that's a bit of a snippet from the song called Quick and Clean. David Murphy joins us this morning. Now, all of the words within that song weren't written by Dave. It was Glen Conroy, which gets me to think, what on earth was he thinking at the time? It's come together really good, Murph, but tell us what it's about, because I heard blades and I'm worrying for the safety of some of the people that were in that song. Good morning to you. Welcome to Cracking the Codes, and congratulations on the new album. Tell us about this song, Quick and Clean, and Glen Conroy's involvement.
Yeah, I sort of come up with the tune and the chorus, and I knew Glen was pretty clever at like poetry and that sort of stuff, and he's a clever man, Glen, And I said to him one day at the trots, I've got a tune, and it's about a fellow who needs to make a quick getaway. That was what the chorus was about, you know. And he said, "Oh, send me the tune." So I recorded myself playing the little chorus that I had. And a day or two later, he gives me a sheet of paper at the trots and had a few lyrics on it. It was kind of like in poem form. So I sort of put my chorus to his lyrics and changed things around a bit. And that's the song, Quick and Clean. And it's a bit dark, about a fellow, about a woman who killed her husband, so I don't know what was, you know, he's a bit of a dark fella, Glen, which we didn't know that about him either.
Bit talking heads-ish, psycho killer.
Yeah, a bit that, yeah. So I don't know what goes happening in the hills around Dalesford when he's out hunting for gold, but anyway, that's what he come up with.
David, do you sing to the horses when you're doing track work in the morning, and with lyrics like that, do you think that it might sort of get them moving a little bit faster?
Oh, I sort of have a pretty good reputation with horses that over race and pull a bit. I kind of get along good with them, but I sing to them in the warm-up and all that, and it's amazing. Their ears flick back and forward, and I reckon it calms them down. So, yeah, no, I'm always singing to them and all that sort of stuff. But, yeah.
Murph, we've played... We're quite a musical show, actually. Like, it's... We're very musical. We played a lot of songs, and a lot of them are quite cheesy, and you sort of go, oh, another racing song, and it's always a bit, you know, predictable. And when Dan threw to the song, I thought, oh, this will be crap. But it was actually very, very good. And I'm not familiar with your band, the Old Melbourne Road, but it's a really rollicking, catchy, sort of mainstream song. It's not one that you'd play, oh, here's what my uncle did. He's into racing, and he did a racing song, and you sort of cringe your way through it. You must be proud of it. Is this a good example of the level of your work?
Yeah, well, I mean, we started off with basically a cover band, so we started off like most bands playing covers that everyone plays, but we decided to go the folky Irish route. That's our heritage and all that sort of stuff. And there wasn't, you know, not a lot of bands doing that. But you know, we thought to be different than most bands, we'll sort of go down that route. So a lot of the songs we've written, so our first album was like a cover album. So a lot of the songs that we've written, we try to keep to our folky. But, you know, when I say we're an Irish band, it's pretty upbeat rock and roll, like it's upbeat Irish music. You know, like in you know, when we play live, it's a pretty good show. It's pretty up there and up and going and all that sort of thing. So with the songs, we try and keep with our folky sort of twang. I'm proud that you think that it's a thinking man's song, and it's not just the going through the motions of crap, as you say, sort of thing. So yeah, no, I'm proud that someone thinks that it's a meaningful song. Yeah.
It took me back to a couple of times at the Port Fairy Folk Festival in the Shebeen tent. Have you ever had the opportunity to play at Folky?
We've played at the pubs in Folky. We've never been part of the festival, but which was an amazing experience because, you know, you're playing at like the Star of the West or one of the pubs there, and 50,000 people go to Port Fairy for the festival, so the biggest crowd. We were setting up one time and you know, said to one of the lads of the band, that shit, we've never had security guards on the side of our stage before, so that was pretty cool. Yeah.
Well, you know, Old Melbourne Road, I mean, they need an entourage. So where did the name, was there an Old Melbourne Road? Is there such a thing as Old Melbourne Road? What was the origin of the name of the band?
Yeah, we come from a town called Dunstan, just outside of Ballarat, and the road going through it's called Old Melbourne Road, so that's it. Yeah.
Right next to Cryle Castle.
Pretty much everyone in the band, the seven of us, six of us grew up on Old Melbourne Road.
And remember last time we had you on, which is a while ago now, Murph, some of the songs are absolutely fantastic. I mean, Poor Ned is a ripper. Galway Girl is it's a classic, isn't it? But, I mean, they're really good songs. A number of thoroughbred trainers have used your services, the band, and even the Hunter Cup night. You've been the band on Hunter Cup night a couple of times, I think. So, I mean, they must have been, certainly being at the trots, people that you know, your peers would have been there. I mean, this is not just something you do once every now and then. I know interrupted a bit by COVID, but it's something you've been doing for a while, you know, you've been quite successful at it. There's some ripper songs that I'm happy to push. As Molly Melbourne would say, do yourself a favour.
Yeah, go by the album, that's it. Yeah, no, it's been doing it about 10 years now, so I mean, I'm 50, so we started late in life, you know. But, and you know, we've never ever gone and asked for a gig anywhere. Like, it's, you know, we've played somewhere and there's been someone in the crowd that's heard us, and, you know, so we ended up playing at the Caride Irish Festival, which that led us down to playing at the Port Ferry, you know, down as part of the folk festival and all that sort of thing. So we've never put ourselves out there to get gigs, but we get enough work, you know. I mean, being a racehorse trainer, like, it's a pretty busy lifestyle, so trying to fit it in amongst all that, and the other lads have all got their jobs and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, COVID aside, if you're doing a gig once a month, it's really enjoyable. And, you know, it was weird going to the trots and playing, like, because I enjoy playing in the band because you can be a different person in your normal life sort of thing and get into character on stage and all that sort of stuff. And then doing that at the trots was a bit weird. But also played at the Birchip trots about the last 4 or 5 years. The Birchip's once a year. It's an amazing meeting to go to. And Lachlan...
And they get big crowds.
Do you wear fishnets on stage? Is there a dramatic transition between your normal life and your stage persona?
Eats the head off a bat.
Not a lot, but... those who know me well know which one's the real me, but anyway.
we won't ask which one it actually is.
We were hoping for something a little bit risque there.
Hey, Murph, scenario's time. You've got a choice between front row, even money favourite in a $1 million Inter-Dominion final, or you can play in front of, let's say, 15,000 at the Maya Music Bowl.
Tricky. I always say that my real job comes first, so now I'll try and win that Inter-Dominion, yeah.
Well, you're a fan of INXS, Dave, and you know where I'm going with this, don't you?
Yeah, big fan of INXS, but no, I'm not sure where you're going.
Well, one of your best horses you've ever had was the same name as a big hit by INXS, By My Side.
Yeah, of course, yeah. I didn't name that one, the owner named that, but A lot of the horses I've got ownership of, you know, or own, they've got like musical themes into them and movies, you know, like you were onto it once. Some of the race balls never got it wrong, right? Never got it right. But I've got one called Willie Wodger out of one of my favourite movies.
Oh, that's funny, isn't it?
Life of Brian.
When
you couldn't call it the other prominent name in that skit because that wouldn't have got through. The Emperor.
But, yeah, I'm glad Dan sort of pronounced his name right because a couple of other callers have got it wrong. They obviously don't know the movie. But
it nearly makes me laugh every time I call it. I keep thinking of the scene in the movie, and I just about, you know, work myself from a race call into a cackle and a laugh.
You could call a horse Waffly.
I've got a few ideas out of the movie to come yet. So I Well, East Wodge is quite a nice little horse. I wish he was a bit better than he is, but to earn the name. But anyway, he's getting there. He'll win soon.
So, Murph, the return of crowds is a double header for you, isn't it? So, because when things open up with the roadmap, it'll open up for the race courses, for crowds, for you to perform in front of as a driver, and also for music venues.
Oh, yeah, it's just a hard couple of years for everybody, and, you know, not out of the woods yet, but hopefully we're getting closer. But, yeah, I mean, going going to the race. It'll be weird going to the races now and having people there. You know, just used to going there, doing your job, and coming home without much interaction. You know, but so it's going to seem strange. You know, it was very strange when going to the races without a crowd. But you know, so that's you know, looking forward to getting people back you know, to the races again. But yeah, you really, really miss the music. I remember catching up with one of the lads out of the band. Things started opening up in a little bit. We went to one of the pubs in town, which is one of the music pubs, and you know, when we left, we said, oh, it wouldn't matter if there was someone playing there real bad, but it'd be real good because you haven't heard nothing. No one played for 8 months, you know?
So, yeah.
Yeah, so looking forward to getting back and doing something. So, yeah, we fitted in, you know, in the last little open-up, we fitted in a couple of gigs, so that was good fun.
Well, look, I know you're very good. I, you know, when you listen to songs sometimes, and you in the middle of the night, you don't subconsciously you don't realise it, but you're humming a song. Sometimes you might have only heard it on the radio once or twice or whatever it might be. I was doing that with your songs when I got into them, you know, a couple of years ago, Dave. So they will resonate with people. I know that. Now, tell us about the album, and if people are wanting to listen to it, obviously you can't live on bread alone. So you want to get some sort of earnings out of it. Where can they check out not just this single Quick and Clean, but it's from the album proper?
Yeah, so it's so in the last, you know, as you know, there's seven of us in the band, and sort of, so we decided, you know, so I come up with that song, and there's a couple, there's about five or six songs that we've written between the lot of us, you know, everyone's did their little bit on the album along with a few covers. So we sort of recorded that. We did it ourselves in the garage that we practice in, and you know, there's a couple of the nephews in the band are pretty clever with all that sort of stuff. And yeah, so we just, through COVID, when you could have a gathering of six or seven people, we'd sort of join up and do all that. But the songs that we've written on the album, they're all the lyrics are in the album, in the sleeve in the album. It's a pretty cool album. And yeah, so
how do you get to listen to the album or get a hold of the album?
Just check out Old Melbourne Road on Facebook page and get in contact through there, and just order a CD and we'll get it posted out to you.
Are all the songs about grisly murders?
No. So there's a couple of happy songs there, Matt.
Right. Okay. All right. Yeah. Hey, Murph. This is annoying because we have a lot of guests on who have had much more interesting lives and do more interesting things than we do, and you've done it. You've added to the list now, so well done.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
He's getting melancholy now, Dave.
Because everyone's fantasy, Dan, is to play. You and I both know it. Everyone's fantasy is to be up there singing, and then when you identify the pretty lady and you give her that sort of little wink in from the stage, and then you know that's a little, you know.
I haven't had a bra thrown to me. I was a pair of knickers yet, anyway.
Is
well,
that right?
Be a good thing, actually.
Well, that's what 2022 is all about, Murph.
That's it, yeah.
Hey, good on you, mate. Well done. And it is a bloody good song, and I reckon all the other songs are obviously of the same calibre, so can't wait to get my free copy sent to the address I'm about to text you.
Dan might have. I'll give Dan one. He might burn it for you, yeah.
Good on you, Murph. Well done. Keep up the great work, and same to all the guys in the band, mate.
Good night, Dan. Thanks, guys. No tears behind this veil of black. Suits and badges at my back. It's not just the wind that's moving around tonight. All my guilty tears just can't make it right for the long run. What's a short walk, yeah. Quick fade away.
Clean.